This series of Let's Make It Rain is sponsored by PensionBee, a leading online pension provider. They're on a mission to make pensions simple so that customers all over the UK can become pension confident and save for a happy retirement. PensionBee's website and app make it simple for customers to combine their old pension pots, contribute flexibly, and withdraw their pension money all in one place. PensionBee offers a range of pension plans for different savings needs, from a flexible self-employed plan to socially responsible plans like their Impact Plan or Sharia Compliant Plan. Head to pensionbee.com or download the app to get started and become pension confident. Remember, when investing, your capital is at risk. And speaking of investing, you've probably heard me say before that we are our own biggest asset by far, and that includes investing in the next generation. I wrote Cash's Queen exclusively for preteen and teenage girls to equip them with everything they need to take control of their financial futures early. It's been translated into 5 languages and is available worldwide. So grab a copy for you and a friend today. Hi, and welcome to the Let's Make It Rain podcast. I'm your host, Davinia Tomlinson. This podcast is for the rainmakers. Those women who are breaking down walls, building their own empires, defying convention and rejecting stereotypes. Women who are unafraid to have open, honest conversations about money among friends and to share the truths we've been told to keep secret. Don't forget to subscribe, share and download wherever you usually get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, then please leave us a 5-star review. Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Let's Make It Rain podcast. Today, I'm over the moon, actually, to be joined by independent London mayoral candidate, Chancellor of the University of Westminster and co-CEO of Blue Water, Natalie Campbell. Natalie, thank you so, so much for being here today. And you know what? I have to say this for the benefit of the rainmakers listening. I have wanted to get you on the podcast for such a long time. And you know, I was super shy. I was super shy to ask you because I watch all of the incredible things that you do. I see how busy you are. And I did that thing that I think, and I'm sure lots of us can attest to this. Please let me know, rainmakers, that it's not just me. You know, that thing that you do where you admire someone and you think, oh gosh, I can't ask because they're going to be too busy or they're going to say no. And it's like, well, what's the worst that can happen? You'll get ignored or the other person will say no. And it's fine. Nobody dies. Right, Natalie?
I always go with what is the worst that can happen? And generally, even though I am busy, I really do try. If someone's asked me to do something, do an interview, do a podcast, I will generally try and respond. It's because I remember what it was like. I remember being 21 and reaching out to the big name entrepreneurs and asking for an interview because I had a magazine. Even if it was no, it was like they heard me, they saw me. So I'm always reach out. If in doubt, reach out.
If in doubt, reach out. I love that. I feel like that's going to be the strapline for this episode. So, Natalie, let's just get straight into it then, because I suppose one of the biggest and most exciting things that I'm sure is happening with you recently, and there is always so much going on with you, you know, you never stop doing super amazing things, is that you are running for London Mayor. And there will be rainmakers across the UK and across the globe that listen to this podcast. What would you want them to know about you? Who is Natalie Campbell? And I suppose, what is something about you that you think would surprise the London voters?
So I'm going to, my potty mouth has come to the fore here. And so I'm going to introduce myself as someone that gives a shit. And the reason that is because I think most of us grow up caring about other people. Most of us grow up and I would hope have a memory of being outside and enjoying being in nature. I would hope most of us have a memory of spending time with people that we love, doing things that we love, whether that's playing as a child or a birthday or a moment later in life. And what I have seen over the last few years is that those things that I took for granted very much in my life are not real for a lot of people now. Mm-hmm. There are young people that don't think that London has opportunities for them. There are so many unheard voices that don't believe their lives can be better and they want to leave London. You know, you can either sit on your hands and say, well, my life is fine, I'm just going to keep plodding on, or you do something about it. And a big motivating force for me was the Child Q case, which, for anyone that doesn't know, Child Q was a 15-year-old black girl who was strip searched in a school in London by the Metropolitan Police. The safeguarding processes all fell down and there was a big report. And, you know, ultimately, I think any normal caring human being would say, we should not be strip searching children, full stop. But the powers that be, which includes the mayor, decided that was not something that they wanted to endorse. And the rage and the fury inside me, because I know I connect with being that 15-year-old girl who realized so much about what I wanted to achieve in the world that I wanted to sort of launch myself into. I decided I wanted to be a CEO at 15. That the idea that that hope was taken away from her motivates me to basically take the mayor's job, if I'm being honest.
Yeah, no, I love that. And I remember the horror that we all will have felt when we saw that case. And I think it almost set off a chain of events that led, it's almost like pulling a thread, because we had no idea that that was happening at all. And of course, there were others that had also been subjected to similar, brutality, you know, for want of a better expression. You know, ultimately, it's an assault on your person as a young woman. And some of the details of that case were truly harrowing to read. It's really encouraging to hear you say, you know, that that was one of the catalysts for you in considering running for London Mayor.
Yeah, absolutely. It doesn't need to be something as harrowing as that, but I think we all have things that we see that we know we could change or do better or fix. And it's really important in the world that we're currently in that we listen to those things and we channel them and we try, if possible, to do something, to make a difference, to give a shit.
Yeah, I love that. And actually, you saying give a shit reminds me of one of my old work colleagues who'd always said to me, Dav, whenever, because I am somebody that gets really passionate, really invested in things that I'm working on, projects that I'm working on, whether it's professional capacity, personal capacity. And she would always say to me, Dav, you have to be really discerning about what you give your energy and attention to, because you've got so much energy and attention, but you're going to burn out. So you've got to decide whether or not you give a shit. And so we would have this secret code sometimes in meetings. And if she would feel like, you know what, Dav, this just really isn't worth it. She would send me a message or an email or something that would literally just say gas, G-A-S. And we would both know what that meant. And we would giggle among ourselves. So Natalie, for anyone that hasn't been following your campaign and that isn't particularly close to what's happening with regards to the London mayoral elections, what would you say will be your top three campaign deliverables when you are selected?
Yes, I love that, the when list. So before I started, you know, throwing stuff out there, which is what some candidates do, I did a survey called What London Wants. And I just said to people, what are your priorities? What do you think the mayor should be focusing on? And how do you rank these areas that the mayor's responsible for in an order? And what came back loud and clear was that people wanted good homes, they wanted safe streets, and they wanted better lives. And, you know, if you've been in London for more than 5 minutes, it's really clear that that should be the goal. So I had to think, well, what's the bit that I bring to it? So the three areas are good homes and happy neighbourhoods, because you can have a good home, but actually we all want to be part of something. We all want to be part of the community. For safe streets, you can only really do that with local police. And policing in London has been centralised and moved from the high street and that really hyper-local connection to sort of a setup that maybe financially costs a lot less, but it isn't delivering for communities. So my focus is safe streets and local police. And then the final bit, the better lives, that's what we all want, right? If I could run on one ambition, it would be to give Londoners better lives. But the bit that I can add is the well communities. I see everything as a system. And when we think about the environment or transport, mental health, opportunities for young people, the role of business in society, all of that for me is about creating well communities so that people can live better lives. So those are my three areas, and the manifesto has been built based on those three priorities.
I mean, just taking a step back and looking at your approach, I mean, I'm fascinated by it, because you started by saying, in contrast to some of the other candidates, past and present, you decided to embark on a research study so that you could make sure that, of course, and I'm sure you would have had your own ideas, you know, as you've outlined already, you know, one of the things that motivated you to throw your hat in the ring in the first place. But rather than you imposing in this very kind of top-down approach your own ideas around what you think Londoners might need, and almost, I mean, there's something, if not patronizing, but, you know, unnecessarily paternalistic about that approach. But you decided to take a bottom-up approach and to decide, and, you know, you decided to speak to the Londoners themselves to find out what were the priorities to them. Because I think sometimes it's easy for us to pontificate about what we think people might want or what we think people might be interested in. And it goes catastrophically wrong because you realize that actually on a very grassroots level, people are interested in what we might consider to be simple things, but which have a monumental impact on day-to-day quality of life. So can you just talk us through that approach? You know, I'm interested in the inner workings of Natalie Campbell's brain and how you approach, you know, problem solving in general.
So I think you hit the nail on the head in the way that you asked the question. My approach is always to listen. We have had leadership in the past, locally, globally, probably even at home, which has been, this is my way and you will respond based on what I am telling you to do. And the reality is that if you really want things to change, if you really want people to live in a way that is congruent to how they see themselves and the ambitions they have, you have to let them decide. You have to let them have responsibility. They have to have and feel like they own the decision, the outcome, and the process. And so just asking a simple question, what do you want, means that the things that I'm saying resonate. And I see it over and over again. People say, you know, what are you going to do? And I say something, they're like, oh, well, yeah, that's what I want. And they're almost surprised. And I understand their surprise because it's counter to what politics is about, which is find some strap lines that people can remember, say some stuff that no one is going to remember. And then when you get into office, just do whatever it is that you want based on what the party tells you to do. So me listening, taking a systems view, once you understand and see systems and the systems approach, it's hard to not see it. So everything for me in London is connected. Things that other people don't think are connected to me are connected. So you can't make a decision in a silo about transport and not think about the impact it has on homes. Or you can't make a decision on homes and not think about the impact it has on the environment or young people, arts and culture. All of these things, it's especially a global city like London, is one big system. And I worked with the mayor for a number of years on one of his boards, which was the Local Economic Action Partnership. And on my first meeting, I said, does anyone have a plan how all of these strategies and all of these financial levers, these big budgets connect, so that we're not duplicating spend and we're maximizing efficiency? Can I have a map, please? And it took about 9 months to get a map because everyone their plans in a silo. So therefore, completely their budgets are being spent in silos. And anyone that runs a business well knows that that's the fastest way to basically create an inefficient business. And so a lot of my pitch also is me talking about running London like a CEO, which some people don't like because they're like, all CEOs, we don't like them. But there's a whole new wave of CEOs that run social enterprises and purpose-led businesses and CEOs that run charities. And I think we spend a lot of time focusing on a word and not the intent of that word. And my intent with the word using CEO is that I'm going to take a systems approach. I'm going to focus on driving effective policymaking that's efficient, that gives people the lives that they want, that delivers for the customer, that delivers for Londoners. And for me, that's really important.
I love what you shared just then about looking for the best practice from the business world and applying it to people's day-to-day existence, because the Rainmakers will know. I mean, it's one of the modules in our Rainmakers Academy, which is run your life like a business. And effectively, we are trying to eliminate inefficiency, eliminate friction, and just make our lives way easier on all possible levels. And of course, we're talking about money, we're talking about wealth creation. But, you know, you can see the same synergies can be extracted in other aspects, you know, and of course, you're doing that and demonstrating how that can be done incredibly well in this process.
I want to just stop on that moment for a minute. So I talk about frictionless travel with my friends all the time. point where it really annoys them. So if I'm going away on holiday, I make decisions based on how do I have the most frictionless end-to-end travel to get to the end destination. And so I always sit in the same seat. I always upgrade to get
far. Stop.
You literally, and if I can't get the same seat on the plane, so you know, generally if I'm going into Europe, I fly EasyJet. I have an EasyJet Plus pass that means, you know, from a queuing perspective, ease of getting through security, end to end. Once I get off that train and I know exactly where I get off the express to then be able to maneuver to then get on the shuttle, like to a T, I can basically ignore the whole process that for a lot of people is quite frustrating and produces quite a lot of anxiety. I can do it pretty much without or on autopilot. You can remove all of the friction from if you just set up a process. To some people, it looks really anal, but to me, it means that my life is much more peaceful.
Yes. And actually, it gives you the opportunity to spend time on the things that you really enjoy doing, because these micro leaks, if you think about these systems or just a chain and a micro leak at every stage in the chain, you know, the first leak, you're thinking, oh, you know, it doesn't matter. It's only a couple of drops. And then the cumulative effect of all of those micro leaks across the chain. Oh, my gosh, you're in a flood. So,
and if you can see it, why would you not fix it? The Zen master's approach to travel, I have it down to a T, literally to a T.
But Natalie, just then you said you asked the million-dollar question, which is, if you can see it, why wouldn't you fix it? I mean, that question, you know, when you look at all sorts of things from relationships, romantic or, you know, platonic, when you look at geopolitical crises, when you look at the economy and when you look at politics, there are so many different arenas in which you think, well, if you can see it, why won't you fix it? And, you know, that leads me on to my next question. I think for you, you know, because one of the things that's unique about your case is that you're running as an independent candidate. Can you just talk us through what that means? Because I think, of course, it lends from, you know, from my perspective, and of course, there is a level of naivety, so you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it lends a level of liberation in terms of the things that you're able to, of course, within the confines of the process, but the things that you're able to propose, your manifesto, your approach, versus you being backed by a party that might have its own political agenda, its own ideas around what they would like the candidate representing them to talk about. So can you just share for us why you're running as an independent candidate and what that means for your campaign?
Yeah, thank you. Great question. And what I would say beforehand is, for anyone that's ever worked in a business, let's go through this scenario. So you arrive day one in your job and you have ambitions of being the CEO, let's just say, or a director or whatever it is, but senior role. And you are told that in order to get to that role, you basically have to play the corporate game. Now, said corporate game goes against all of your values because it means you have to be self-interested. It means you have to politic. It means you have to backstab the people that you're working with. It means that you have to lie to your customers. And so you ultimately say, this is not for me. And you become an entrepreneur. That's exactly what I'm doing with this political process that I'm going through. I looked at the party system. I haven't been involved in politics before. I've never been a political researcher or any of those things. But I looked at the system and saw how self-interested it is if you are within a party because you have an ambition of becoming a minister or a secretary of state. And so even if your values and the things you care about are care leavers or opportunities for young people, to get to the end goal job, you probably have to put those things on the shelf and conform. I'm not someone that conforms at all. So doing it as an entrepreneur, doing it with a startup approach, you know, bootstrapping my way through this means I have the freedom to really serve the customer. You know, if we think about all of the challenger brands, from a Monzo taking on a HSBC, or I'm trying to think of a, you know, another smaller brand that's taken on a bigger brand, but we can all think of some. The reason that they've had mass customer appeal is because everyone's been annoyed at the big company being clunky and inefficient and not listening and not innovating. And so I really do believe that on the 2nd of May, 1.5 million Londoners will wake up and say, do you know what? I'm going to choose a different brand to represent me. I'm going to choose a different brand because these big businesses haven't been listening and they're taking me for granted. And process-wise, to get onto the ballot, independents have to work much harder than the parties. So we have to secure nominations from across the city. So we need 330 signatures, which breaks down to 10 signatures from every borough in London and the City of London Corporation. Now, if you're in a party, someone else does all of that for you because you have party associations, you have access to databases to get people's electoral roll numbers. As an independent going into this, I knew nothing about any of these processes. And so I had to learn how to do it all. I then had to create the infrastructure to go out and get all of this information. And then all of the databases are not accessible to independent candidates. So you literally don't know that the people that you're signing up are registered to vote, that they have electoral roll numbers right until the very process. And so for me, it was another light shone on the parts of our democracy that don't actually serve the people, that really serve the interests of the big parties. And it's something now that I sort of am hell-bent on changing. But it also, it showed me that even at 40, with a few businesses under my belt and, you know, 4 years being the CEO of a company that I didn't found, I've still got my entrepreneurial spirit. I've still got my entrepreneurial hustle. Like, I know how to do this. And that excites me. That gives me a bit of fizz in the morning when I'm feeling tired. I'm like, no, this is what I've been doing my whole career. How do I entrepreneur this? How do I bootstrap this? How do I do this in a Natalie way? And there's a lot of joy. There's lots of moments where I can just pause and accept the joy of the fact that I can still do this thing that is a superpower for a lot of people. I can still do it. I haven't lost it, even in my older age.
I love that. Please don't say older age because I'm 42. But I hear you so completely. Oh my goodness, Natalie, when you said, you know, for lots of people, and certainly from your own experience, and this is something that resonates with me in particular, the point about being in the corporate world and realizing all of the things that you have to do, everything that it takes to climb the career ladder. And I know that those people, particularly those that have worked within a particular industry, you know, coming from a finance background, for example, like me, there are so many things that you have to do. You might think it's just about the work. It's just about your competence. The approach I took was the approach that I take into everything else in my life, which was you just got to pass the exam, staff. You know, if you're the most qualified in the room, then you're going to be the most senior in the room, which of course, as we all know, is not the case. You know, there's almost no correlation there. That some of the things that you have to do might put you at odds with your own personal value system. But in addition, if you are someone like me, and it sounds like you're very similar, that's free-spirited and wants to be creative about the ways and the steps that you take to achieve a particular goal, that you might have to zig as well as zag, and that it might not be a completely linear process, then you can find yourself feeling like the corporate world is a straitjacket. And so I'm interested in what you shared about, you know, in all of your various endeavors as an entrepreneur and as someone now who's co-CEO of a business. It's a social enterprise, right? Blue Water. Some of the, I suppose, the hard lessons that you've learned and you've cultivated along the way that basically mean that you are a prime candidate for this role, so that when you go into this role on day one, you're ready to go by virtue of some of the experiences that you've had, particularly, I suppose, in your current role at Blue Water.
Yeah. So you can do anything if you have people behind you. I joined Blue 3 weeks before we went into lockdown. I'd met my team once in person, and I didn't see them again until the September. And so digitally, whilst people were, you know, thinking about loved ones, their own health, homeschooling, I had to build up trust with my team so that, A, they would follow me. You know, they didn't know me. They didn't know anything about me and whether or not I'd be able to get the business through what was a big crisis for us. You know, we're a B2B-only business that serves workplaces and hospitality. Those were the industries that shut down almost immediately. And so the idea of really putting people at the heart of everything that I do is the thing that I would take into City Hall on day one. Being honest, A, about my skills, about my mental health, about my ways of seeing the world, is so, so, so key to then enabling people to see why you make the decisions you make. really early on in Baloo, I asked my senior leadership team, or what then became my senior leadership team, to talk about their shadow sides. Who are you on your worst day? Because if we all knew that, then when people displayed those elements of being in their shadow sides, the person on the receiving end knew not to take it personally and knew that it was probably a moment to stop the conversation and ask, are you okay? What can I do to support you? How can I help you? Or just to give that person space. And the way that my team did that for me in the January, which I think it felt like lockdown, like six, I had moved to the coast and I was in Hove alone. It was January. It was dark. It was cold. We just had Christmas. I'd spent Christmas alone because we were locked down. And it was January 4th. And we had a team call and I said to the team, you know, I'm feeling totally discombobulated. I can't imagine spending another 3 months not seeing or speaking to anyone. And so if I'm just not really with it over the next couple of weeks, I need you to give me backup. And they all immediately jumped in and said, we've got you. And actually them saying, we've got you, meant that after a bit of a nap, woke up and I was fully on it and ready to go. And that's the point that I'm making around mental health. I think about mental health as mental wellness. I always focus on how do I make sure that I am in the best position to be well across the board, and mentally well is so important, especially if you're a leader. But we need to have those conversations. And in having those conversations now, 4 years on, my senior leadership team, we know each other. We can ask each other challenging questions. We can show up for each other and we know that we can ask for help. And in a big role like running London, there will be times when I make decisions that not everyone will like. Women in politics get, you know, a raw deal across social media and mainstream media. Being a Black woman in politics, when you add all of those layers together, not expecting this to be easy at all, but being able to say, do you know what, someone saying this thing about me really affected me, that has power, that has value. And it also then delegitimizes whatever thing they may have said, because I have enough people around me that will go, but you know it's not true.
Yes.
Know who you are. We know who you are. We see you. That's really important.
Natalie, I love that so much. I mean, there are so many different themes to what you've just shared, but I think, you know, the point about as a senior leader, feeling comfortable being vulnerable or recognizing that actually it is a responsibility as a senior leader to be vulnerable, because in doing so, you empower others, perhaps more junior than you, from feeling that it's okay, that they're in a psychologically and emotionally safe space in which they can reveal something that they might be struggling with as well. And, you know, I know that there is a lot of debate and a lot of chat. You know, sometimes if you read certain comment sections for certain publications, I will not name them, and that, you know, it might talk about wokeism or this snowflake generation and how we're so feeble and, you know, we can't withstand any kind of pressure, when actually, if you flip that on its head, perhaps it could be argued that we are striving to be the most mentally resilient generation by being so vulnerable and by recognizing that actually it is not incumbent upon us as individuals to fix every problem or every challenge that we might have, but actually to recognize there is power in reaching out to someone else and saying, can you help top me up a bit? Because I'm feeling a bit flat. And that's okay. Because I'm sure, as you've outlined, you know, the outcomes of you sharing meant that others feel, you know, they almost, their shoulders drop, they can exhale a bit and they can go, oh gosh, she's a regular person, versus, you know, the way that in the past we put CEOs in this category and it becomes almost demagoguery, doesn't it? You know, we put them on this pedestal and we can't even view them as regular people, so that when something does happen, everybody is astounded because you think, oh, I didn't know they had feelings. I didn't know they had a family.
Crazy, you know, right?
It's wild.
we're human, absolutely human.
Yeah.
But, you know, we have created. So if we think about, I don't know where you went to school, but thinking about school, you know, the headmaster, mistress.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think of them as...
Oh, they were dehumanized. Oh, totally. If you saw them in the supermarket, you were like, what the hell is Miss doing in Asda?
Yeah. Into them possibly later in life, where, oh, you were only 24 trying to control a 15-year-old girl.
Lordy. Yeah.
Other priorities, which did not involve PE. That is how you go through school. And then you go from school to some other educational establishment into the workplace, and we just replicate that dehumanized process in terms of looking at authority. And I'm glad that we're moving away from that world and just showing up as human beings trying our best. The caveat on that, though, is if you choose to take a leadership position, it is incumbent on you to be a good leader. Incumbent on you to do things that build strength and resilience and openness and honesty. And it is incumbent on you to take pressure, because you are ultimately accountable for a lot of things. But you can do all of that and still be kind and still be who you are. And to come back to the strength bit, in being vulnerable, it creates a strength. My SLT, like, we are so strong as a unit because of the vulnerability and the times that we had together during the pandemic.
Yeah, I mean, the pandemic really was our collective reckoning, wasn't it? And it was, you know, it was the point at which I'm sure for lots of organisations and for lots of senior leadership teams, or, you know, just colleagues in general, it was the point at which we saw people as they actually were for the first time in lots of cases. And, you know, I hope that it, you know, sparked a turning point in terms of our interpersonal relationships. I know that there have been reports of things just pinging back to what they were pre-pandemic. But to the extent that we are able to retain some of those lessons and some of that resilience that was forged in the fire, really, you know, I'm sure it will make for much better, much healthier, happier workplaces all around. But Natalie, you talked about, and this is something that was on my mind, really, and I was trying to think about how to broach it, because I recognize that as a woman, as a Black woman, there are probably certain questions that you get asked all the time, and they can start to feel, or you could start to feel really jaded by them. You know, you shouldn't have to feel that you are a representative voice for all Black women in senior leadership positions, or, you know, as a senior leader for all women, that you are a representative voice for all women that have climbed the career ladder and, you know, some of the challenges. But I do think that there is an important intersection that you embody or that you straddle, and particularly given the arenas in which you have already excelled and now you're about to dominate a new one, you know, in terms of the world of politics. I'm very interested to know how you kind of tread that fault line in terms of making sure, and we've just talked about, you know, your mental wellness, because I think, you know, as you rightly said, you know, in the UK at least, and I'm sure this picture is replicated across the Western world, if you're a woman, if you're a Black woman in politics, the level of vitriol that you will be subjected to is off the chart. I mean, it's completely incomparable to anything that anybody else would experience. And it's impossible, even for me as a fellow Black woman, but not one that's in the world of politics, it would be impossible for anybody that's outside that world to ever really appreciate what that pressure feels like. How do you navigate that? I suppose doing so many audacious things anyway in your past, you know, you've excelled in so many ways, as I say, but, you know, when we talk about the glass ceiling, there's almost a concrete ceiling for Black women in many respects. How have you navigated that, and how are you managing to make peace with it or make sure that your mental wellness is preserved during this process?
Yeah. And so this is a really, not a hard question for me to answer, but I appreciate that there'll be lots of people that do not connect with what I'm about to say. And I totally get why. I totally get that I have a privilege to even be able to say this. So, at 15, I decided I wanted to be a CEO. Anyone that's working class, you know, I'm not even, if you remove the female bit and you remove being Black, just being young and being working class and deciding you want to be a CEO, already just the barriers are plentiful. And so I started moving through my life with a very high sense of agency. And the term agency, for anyone that doesn't know, is just, you know, how much you believe you control your circumstance, scenarios, the things that happen in your life. For any entrepreneur majors or people that studied entrepreneurship, the locus of control. I have a very high sense of agency. So for a long time, I just navigated the world saying, I'm just going to be as badass as I want to. And if people don't get me like me, that is not my problem. It's their problem. And I have never been afraid to be myself. And I've always looked at organizations and thought and said, okay, do I think I will thrive in that environment? And so you and I got to university. I started my first business. I started my first proper business at 19. By 21, I had a retail franchise. I looked at the milk round options of all of the big corporates, and I knew I would not thrive. I would have to be firmly in a box. And I shunned that pathway completely. But again, I could do that because I understood systems. I could do that because I had a high sense of agency. And I could do that because I have the entrepreneurial tools in my arsenal to do it. So as I moved then into later life and joining boards and being in, you know, environments where I was sometimes, well, oftentimes the only one, and you can say young person, black person, woman, visible tattooed person, shaved head, whatever it is, the only one, I never focused on it. I focused on what am I here to do? What change am I here to bring? And how do I build relationships with the people in this room to get to that end outcome? And it was usually an end outcome for other people, not myself, for other people. So if I saw an organization that was making decisions for communities without someone from that community around the table, I would join that organization to make sure that better decisions were being made. And I just did it. I didn't think about it too much. I didn't ruminate it. I just did it. So when you say concrete ceiling, I absolutely get why you say that. When people say glass ceiling, I absolutely get it. But my entrepreneurial instinct is you go under, over, around it, ignore it. You just keep going. And if I didn't believe that, I wouldn't be running for Mayor of London as an independent candidate. I wouldn't be spending my life savings going on a journey that is the closest thing to impossible that I've ever done. But I deeply, 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 deeply believe that you create the weather in your life.
Oh my God, and I love that.
I do.
We are rainmakers, Natalie. I love that. That could be a strap line. You create the weather in your life. Beautifully put.
But I think it connects to where, you know, the origins of the idea of rainmakers comes from. I think if you hold on to those principles, then other people's discrimination and other people's issues with you, they're not even secondary. They're like tucked in a box under the bed somewhere. That's not to say things don't hurt when people see them, but the reality of what happens in your life and where you go and who you spend your time with and being able to still find joy because you know you're doing the work. I know I'm using all of the muscles in my body to do this right now. Like, I know I'm alive going through the process. There's so much value in that. And I choose to focus on that versus everything else. And I get some people just won't like that because they're like, but there are problems and you should call them out. And I do. And I change things. And I don't then shout about it and throw it all over social media. I get it done and I keep moving.
Oh my gosh, that's a whole, I feel like that's the whole podcast. I could just say, right, let's wrap it up here because it's so well put. And I think, first of all, it's refreshing. It's a refreshing perspective because I echo your sentiments. And I've shared in previous interviews, previous conversations elsewhere, in which I have said that unpopular opinion, whilst I can't say I haven't been discriminated against, I don't feel the impact because I'm like a Teflon Don. So in my mind, it doesn't mean things don't happen, but I am a sunbeam. I am a radiator. So I am going to go into every room. And if I feel that that room isn't one in which I can thrive, shine, make an impact, make a difference, I'm happy to exit the room. I'm not in rooms trying to, I'm not there with a chisel and a hammer trying to, like, I'm like, you know what? There are so many rooms. So I'm going into a different room. And this is a lesson for my daughters as well. It doesn't mean that you don't persevere and you're not determined, but it does mean that you have to have the discernment to say, this is what I'm good at. This is what I bring. You can't dim my shine, even if you wanted to, because I come into these rooms and I'm going to sparkle and I've got the glitter and I've got the magic. So anybody, irrespective of race, gender, ethnicity, all of these things, if you can't see that I'm the glitter, that's okay. Then that's, I'm sorry for you.
Yes,
I'm sorry for you.
That's your, yeah. I'm going to keep it moving.
Right?
Yeah.
And I'm so delighted that you amplified that, because I think, you know, particularly for any of the younger rainmakers that might be listening, I know that I've got mentees that listen, and, you know, there are lots of teenage girls, you know, young women on the cusp of adulthood, and I want them to hear that message, particularly as you described. We know that the UK is very class-based in many respects, and we know that, you know, that has an impact on social mobility and wealth prospects and all of these different things. But you had already identified that that was what you wanted to do. You wanted to be a CEO. You knew the path that you wanted to pursue, and you had that determination and single-mindedness at such an early age, which is a really rare quality. But I want other young women to hear that and say, you know, gosh, this woman who seems untouchable, so much so that even Dav was shy to ask her to be a guest on the podcast, actually, she's a regular person. That's really important and really powerful. And I think we do need to be mindful of, I always return to this example, but in Chimamanda's TED talk, in which she talked about a single story, it's important that we don't find ourselves boxed into a single story, whatever our background is, that we don't say, well, actually, there are no prospects for me because I come from this part of Birmingham or this part of London, or my parents are from a certain ethnicity, and therefore that must determine my long-term prospects in life.
So I'm going to add to that. If the phrase, they won't let me, is anywhere in your vernacular, anywhere in your body, anywhere in your DNA, in, you know, rolling through your blood, they won't let me, find a way to get rid of it. Find a way, dance it out, shake it out, sing it, whatever it is, but remove it. As soon as you get rid of that feeling, that idea, the world is your oyster. And the daily joy of being awake, feeling that freedom, is life-changing. And I'm sure, you know, Dav, this is why you're doing the podcast, right? If you can bottle it for everyone.
Right? Yes.
It's a gift. It is a gift.
This really is a gift. I mean, it's something that I say to the rainmakers all the time. We don't want to approach as women. Of course, everybody knows, you know, my whole thing around Raincheck was recognizing that parts of the investment management industry were broken with regard to the level of financial advice that women were able to get access to, the level of financial education around different types of, you know, investment instrument that women were being able to understand. Women that have high intellect, that are doing amazing things in their careers, that are managing their homes like a boss, and yet are coming up against so many roadblocks when it comes to building wealth or even learning about it or just normalizing the conversation around money. And the thing that I would always say to the rainmakers is, you know, let us focus on what we are able to control. All that noise outside, and of course, those things are important. We do need to amplify the message around the gender pay gap, the gender investing gap, the gender pensions gap. There is a very real practical imperative that means we must do something to save into our pension so that we are not left in pensioner poverty and we're not left destitute in later life. But outside of those things, we don't want to be beleaguered by all of the noise that might say, oh, women are risk averse, or women are bad at investing, or women don't know how to manage their money. The vast majority of which is BS, it's absolute rubbish. But I think the more you can hear those messages, the more you start to believe, well, if they're saying it, and if the study says it, then it must be true. Not realizing all of the different things that we've already smashed in our own lives, the achievements we've already made. And I always say to them, you've already established the blueprint for your own success in every single aspect of your life. So you've taken that blueprint and applying it to your money management, and applying the same blueprint to your relationships. You know, you might be at work and decide, you know what, this job really isn't serving me. I'm not thriving in this team. I'm not thriving in this organization. And you move. That blueprint can also be applied to your relationship as well. You don't have to stay in a terrible marriage or a terrible relationship because you think, oh, well, I have to because of what society might say or the other people around me might say. And everything that you've shared just then is perfectly correlated with this idea of taking control of what we're able to control and putting our mindsets first, investing in mindset so that we recognize we've got everything that we need to basically power through and to maneuver around some of these roadblocks whilst recognizing and being respectful of the fact that not everybody can approach it in the same way.
Absolutely. And I do, you know, in the final minutes, I want to share the personal side of this, because I'm sure people are like, okay, so we get this from a business perspective, but what about relationships? What about how you manage your money? Are you exactly the same?
Yeah.
I start with the relationships piece. I do not have relationships that do not bring me peace. And single. By choice. I don't even really like the term single. I'm 40 and me. The same feeling that I apply to how I want to show up in my career, just in life, is the same principles that I apply to how I want to feel every single day that I look at. And I think there are wonderful out there, but it's finding the right match for me. And in the same way that I would not compromise by taking a role or a job that didn't benefit me, I would not do that. Relationship. On the money side, I won't surprise anyone, have never been afraid about talking about money. At university, I convinced all of my friends at university to start talking about the salaries and promotions that we were going through, so that we had a sounding board. And so in my own life, going from employment into entrepreneurship, I've always been very transparent on money and numbers. What I didn't have was the long-term planning piece. So I didn't really believe in pensions, and I never really thought about buying anywhere until my mid-30s. And that's because I wanted literally to be footloose and fancy-free. I wanted to make sure that if I wanted to put some stuff in a suitcase and get on a plane tomorrow, I could go. And I didn't like having any ties. But at 35, I decided I wanted to buy a property. A few years before that, I actually opened my first pension. And so I had to start overpaying into my pension because I'd never had one before. So I actively overpay into my pension. I managed to save a 5% deposit. And because I knew I couldn't buy in London, I bought in Hove, which is near Brighton. So I looked at, well, if I can't do it here, where can I do it? And where can I do it in a place that gives me joy, versus just saying, well, I can't buy in London, full stop.
Yes.
First property in Hove with £18,000 in September 2020. So I benefited from the frozen stamp duty. And then I bought something that I needed to do up so I knew I could add some value to it. But I didn't own a property until 36, you know, going on 37. So for context, people listening thinking I had it together and I had a property in my 20s, not at all. I've always saved, but I've saved for an outcome. And now I just save to save. And there was one more thing I was going to say. So I overpay my mortgage as well. The reason I overpay my mortgage is because I'm thinking so long term. The thing that I want to know is that I always have a home, and wake up in the morning and have to think about how much that home costs to run. And so removing that from my life is important for me. Lots of my friends are like, oh, but you've got equity in it, you could buy more properties, and. That's just not how I choose to think about my own wealth, my own wealth planning. And I think it comes from my granddad. My granddad always says, you can only live in one room of your house at any one time.
I love that. Jamaican grandparents.
Seriously, the lines.
Yes, the killer lines, always.
Up in the same family home. So I don't even have the instinct to buy somewhere and move and do that multiple times over my life. If I could live in one house for the rest of my life, I absolutely would. So those are the things that I do for my own sort of wealth peace of mind. And I've got stocks and shares, and I invest in companies, and I do things that mean that I can hopefully be in a place where I can relax into old age. But I won't ever stop working. I'm not doing this for retirement. I believe in mini retirements. I live the joy of my life every single day versus putting off for a moment down the line. I just want to know that at some point in my life, I don't wake up and think this is what it costs per day to live.
Gosh, I love that so much. And the thing is, I feel like I could talk to you for another hour, but we are rapidly running out of time. And I still got a couple of questions that I want to get through with you very quickly. So what does it mean against that backdrop and everything that you've just shared in terms of your personal relationship with money? What does it mean to be a wealthy woman to you? you know, in all of the different ways that wealth can manifest itself outside of purely just financial.
So I never hear the word wealth and think financial at all, actually.
Interesting. Okay.
My words are joy and bliss.
Love that.
When you feel joy, and joy for me is very different to happiness. When you feel joy, deep joy, and you're in your bliss, there is no money you could pay me to remove that. None at all.
Mm.
And that's what I personally strive for. That is what a wealthy life looks like for me. The tools to get there, yeah, consist of making good financial decisions, but it consists of so much more as well. It's about the people that I have around me. It's about the food I put in my body. It's about the things that I see when I look out the window. It's about the smells I, you know, smell when I walk into my house. It's about so much, so much, so much more.
I love that. And it's a perfect word combination, isn't it? Joy and bliss. Joy feels cellular. It's not purely superficial, but you know, you could almost put joy and bliss in a bottle, shake it and label it ecstasy. So I love that. I love the idea of joy and bliss. And so my final question then, because we obviously here at Raincheck are big supporters of your campaign, we want to do anything that we can do to amplify what you are doing so that we make sure that you are in the hot seat on May the 2nd.
Mm-hmm.
So what would you say to anybody that still, there shouldn't be anyone, particularly those who listen to this, but who still feels a bit disenfranchised by the political process, to get them to come out and vote? What would you say to them?
Yeah. The system is created to make sure that you don't vote.
Mm.
Now, I'm going to say that again. The system is created to make sure that you do not vote.
That's wild.
So the thing that you are feeling, if you're saying my vote doesn't count, you've let them win. The minute we show up and vote, the minute the 58% of Londoners show up and vote on May 2nd, or the 58% of Londoners that didn't vote show up on May 2nd, everything changes because it means they need to listen. And when I say they, I mean all of the parties. They make policies for a very small minority of voters that they actively encourage to show up and vote time and time again. And it makes their lives easier to focus on those groups. So let's change the narrative. Don't let them win by doing the thing that they have designed every single system to get you to a place of believing that that is your choice not to vote. It's not your choice. It's their choice imposed upon you.
That's brilliant. That is a fabulous way to end this episode, and actually a really thought-provoking way to end it. The system is set up for you to not vote. That, I mean, I'm going to be thinking about that long after this episode. Natalie, thank you so, so much for your time today. Brilliant conversation. What would you like people to do next? I mean, we know the big one, but why don't you say it for us? What do you want them to do?
So a couple of things. So you need to be registered to vote. So if you've never voted before, it's unlikely you are registered. So you need to go online, literally just type in register to vote, and it will take you through a process. The deadline to be registered is the 16th of April if you want to vote in the mayoral elections and I think the general election. To vote on actually the actual vote day, you need ID. So a driver's license, a passport. If you don't have those things, then you'll need to register to get a piece of formal identification. There are lots of sites that are giving them out for free now that we're in a general election year. And then finally, show up on the 2nd of May and cast your vote for me. And even if you still can't cast your vote for me, just vote. It's important that we show up in the voting data. They know everyone. The vote. They know your demographics. They know your name. They know if you voted. So showing up sends a very clear message.
Brilliant. Natalie Campbell, wishing you lots of success and looking forward to seeing you as our next London Mayor following the 2nd of May. Hi everyone, Davinia here. I hope you've enjoyed today's episode. If any of what you heard resonated and you'd like to find out more about how Raincheck is helping women all over the world build sustainable long-term wealth, then visit our website at raincheck.com and join the mailing list for more commentary, tips and opinion on how you can start taking steps to leveling up your financial well-being today. You can follow us on social media at Raincheck, and don't forget to share, like, rate, review and subscribe. See you next time.